From NPR News, it's Day to Day. Everyone is hoping for an economic turnaround this year, and until that happens, many of us are looking for solid financial advice to keep our heads above water. Here to answer your personal finance questions is Michelle Singletary. Hi, Michelle.
Hi.
So we're going to start off with a letter about a rule known as the 72T rule. It comes from Joan Fantasia. She lives here in Los Angeles. She's a retired journalist from the LA Times. She's 53 years old, and she asks, can you explain the 72T? There is no way I can hold out until age 59 and a half to get my 401k money. What's going on here, Michelle?
Well, the 72T rule is a rule from the IRS that states that if you have an IRA, individual retirement account, you can withdraw a fixed amount of money for a minimum of 5 years or until you're 59 and a half, whichever comes last. That's an important point. So let's say you're just a year into this and you turn 59 and a half. You still have to play out that five-year rule. So it's whichever comes last. And basically, owners have to still pay ordinary income on the distribution, but you don't have to pay that 10% penalty. So since she's so close, she could utilize this, but you have to be very, very careful about that, because if you miscalculate and you don't take enough or you take too much, you're going to be hit with that 10% penalty.
Here's a more general question. This comes from Laureen Lynn, and she says, I am a fool with money. Is there a general book or books that cover the basics of finance? What do you recommend, Michelle?
You know, there are a couple books that I really love. Let's start with College Savings, How to Go to College Almost for Free by Ben Kaplan. This is a young man who went to, I think it was Harvard, and raised like $90,000 in scholarship money. It's a great book, kind of leads you on how to apply for various scholarships. And these aren't just scholarships for like the brilliant and the genius. He just walks you through how to get as most money as you can for college. The other book is The Best Way to Save for College, A Complete Guide to 529 Plans by Joseph Hurley. For retirement, check out How to Retire Happy, The 12 Most Important Decisions You Must Make Before You Retire. It's by one of my former colleagues at the Washington Post, Stan Hendon. And the good thing about this book is he's addressing the issues that a lot of people sort of forget about or don't think about, even some of the mistakes that he and his wife made. So it's really a very honest look at the things that you need to consider when you retire, how to retire happy. Now, for a general basic financial book, get Smart and Simple Financial Strategies for Busy People by Jane Bryant Quinn. I love Jane's work. It's a really easy book to read. You don't even have to read it from beginning to end. You can skip chapters as it applies to you.
Okay, last question, Michelle. This comes from Jennifer Millsap from Molino, Oregon. She's married to a construction superintendent who recently was laid off. They're worried about their mortgage. The payments are about $650 a month. Jennifer has already turned a 30-year mortgage into a 12-year mortgage, which means she doubled each of her monthly payments. She asked if she should pay off the mortgage quickly, making higher payments now, or should she put the money into savings and stick to the low $650 payment?
Because her husband has lost her job, I would stop making the extra mortgage payments. They need to preserve cash until he gets another job. So if it takes longer for her husband to get a job, they have the money to pay for the everyday expenses like food and utilities and such.
Michelle Singletary answering your questions. Thank you so much, Michelle.
You're welcome.
Michelle Singletary hosts a housing special on TV1. You can check your local listings for that. She is also Day to Day's personal finance contributor.
And back now with Day to Day. When the television sitcom Scrubs returns for a new season tonight, it will be on a different network, ABC.
Why the switch after 7 years on NBC? Here's critic Andrew Wallenstein with an explanation of a rare TV trend.
How exciting is it that you run this place now? I'm so proud of you. It's like a whole new day has dawned.
Do me a big favor there, Barbu. Get that prescription filled for me.
One chill pill.
It's for you. Unlimited refills.
To understand what happened to this comedy set in a hospital, let's borrow some medical terms. Think of Scrubs as a transplanted heart. It was barely beating for all those years for its donor, NBC. You might say it was deprived of the TV equivalent of oxygenated blood. Marketing. The network was so busy pumping the life out of Scrubs, shuffling it around the schedule so much that it hemorrhaged more and more viewers with each move. But even a faint pulse is enough for ABC, which has flatlined in the comedy department in recent years. So a show that once seemed on life support has been resuscitated in a new body, leaving one question. Can it survive? If TV history is any indication, maybe. Yes, strange as it might seem for a show to suddenly switch networks, it's by no means unprecedented. In fact, some of TV's most iconic shows have changed channels, but for very different reasons, with very different results. Even the Beaver was a lever. After one season on CBS in 1957, it jumped to ABC the following year. Turns out the show's main sponsor, Purina Dog Chow, offered the latter network a sweeter deal. 50 years later, money is still typically the primary factor in network swaps. Just look at the Bravo hit Project Runway, which Lifetime is trying to steal away by paying the producers more, a move that has the two companies battling it out in court. The thing about TV shows is, the longer they run, the more expensive they get to produce. That's why the WB passed on Buffy the Vampire Slayer back in 2001, when it eked out two more seasons on UPN. Same thing happened in 1965 to that sitcom classic My Three Sons. But in that case, ABC's loss was CBS's gain. The show managed to make it seven more seasons. Sometimes a change of scenery can work wonders, as NBC found out the hard way twice during the 1990s. Both Baywatch and JAG floundered for a year at the Peacock Network before going on to long, successful runs elsewhere. But more often than not, these kind of swaps are futile attempts to squeeze the last ounce of juice out of an already drained fruit. Taxi, Different Strokes, and Family Matters are just a few of the shows that made for sloppy seconds. Scrubs seems like it's likely to follow in that tradition. Eight seasons is like a century, given most comedies are lucky to last eight episodes. The fact that ABC thinks it can extract value out of Scrubs' last lap speaks to the state of diminishing returns on TV today.
Andrew Wallenstein is deputy editor of The Hollywood Reporter.
The deepest canyon on Earth is about to become a protected area. The Mariana Trench is part of three new marine national monuments in the Pacific Ocean. President Bush plans to create those monuments today. With the stroke of a pen, he'll protect a total area larger than California. These preserves are designed to conserve areas untouched by humans, NPR's Richard Harris reports.
For more than 100 years, when we've thought of protecting the Earth's natural wonders, we've mostly thought about the stuff on land, places we can see. But some of the Earth's truly spectacular sites are actually underwater, such as the Mariana Trench out near the island of Guam.
It's the sole place on Earth that has huge active mud volcanoes, one more than 31 miles across.
Josh Reichert at the Pew Environment Group has been making the case for preserving this unique volcanic landscape in perpetuity.
The trench contains the second boiling pool of liquid sulfur ever discovered. The first one is on one of Jupiter's moons.
And you want exotic wildlife? You got it.
It has the only known living bird which uses volcanic heat to incubate its eggs.
That would be the Micronesian megapod. And now Reichert will get his wish to preserve this area. Mr. Bush is expected to declare much of the trench and waters around some nearby islands as a marine national monument. In fact, that's one of three monuments the president plans to establish today. A second is around Rose Atoll near American Samoa, and the third is the seas surrounding seven islands, U.S. territories, scattered way out in the Pacific. Their remoteness is actually what makes them special.
These places are so pristine that they are like time machines that take us hundreds of years in the past.
Enrique Sala at the National Geographic Society is one of the very few people on Earth who has actually had a chance to swim around some of these remote islands, which are surrounded by coral reefs.
You jump in the water and immediately you are surrounded by 10, 15 sharks that are very curious and many other fishes that have probably never seen humans before. So it is like the sensation that Darwin must have had when he stepped in the Galapagos for the first time.
And this is not simply a joyful experience for the occasional visitor. For science, Sala says it is an exceptionally rare opportunity to visit a reef that's at the peak of its health.
These places are the last instruction manual we have to understand how coral reefs function and also to understand the magnitude of our impact on these coral reefs.
Ideally, Sala says they can be used as a model to rebuild reefs elsewhere around the world. Now, in 2006, when President Bush created another marine monument near Hawaii, he won strong praise from conservationists. Diane Regas at the Environmental Defense Fund is now delighted that the president has decided to more than double the size of marine protected areas with his latest declaration, with the four marine monuments together protecting 350,000 square miles.
We've been working to preserve these areas because there's nowhere else like them on Earth. I think we'd call this a bigger-than-Texas-size gift for all of us.
Josh Reichert at Pew is also celebrating the actions of a president who is not exactly known for his environmentalism.
It's a monumental achievement if you add up all of the areas that have been protected over the course of the past 2.5 years. It's far greater than any other person has ever done.
The ocean is so vast, these reserves save just the tiniest bit. But Reichert says it's an important bit. There is a lot of life and wonder in the ocean, and it's under more stress now than ever before. Richard Harris, NPR News.
The prolific and award-winning mystery writer Donald Westlake died of a heart attack New Year's Eve. He was 75. Westlake wrote over 100 novels. Many of his crime novels were written under the pen names Richard Stark and Tucker Coe. He used his own name for his comic novels about an inept thief named John Dortmunder. The movies Point Blank, The Hot Rock, and Payback were adapted from Westlake's novels. Westlake's screenplay for the film The Grifters was nominated for an Oscar. Here's something he told me in 1988 about crime and crime writing.
The essential difference between a fiction writer and a criminal is the level of imagination. That the criminal can imagine committing the crime and can imagine how the crime should be worked out. The fiction writer can imagine committing the crime, can imagine how the crime can be worked out, and can imagine getting caught. So the criminal who can't imagine part number three goes ahead and does it, and the fiction writer who can imagine part number three just writes about it.
I spoke with Donald Westlake again in 1997, after the publication of his novel The Axe, about the desperation of a man who is downsized out of his job at a paper mill. He sends out resumes, but nothing happens. As he slips out of the middle class, he devises a plan to get back his income, health insurance, and security. The plan requires killing off his competition. Here's a reading from the opening of The Axe.
I've never actually killed anybody before, murdered another person, snuffed out another human being. In a way, oddly enough, I wish I could talk to my father about this, since he did have the experience, had what we in the corporate world call the background in that area of expertise, he having been an infantryman in the Second World War, having seen action in the final march across France into Germany in 44-45, having shot at and certainly wounded and more than likely killed any number of men in dark gray wool, and having been quite calm about it all in retrospect. How do you know beforehand that you can do it? That's the question. Well, of course, I couldn't ask my father that, discuss it with him, not even if he were still alive, which he isn't, the cigarettes and the lung cancer having caught up with him in his 63rd year, putting him down as surely, if not as efficiently, as if he had been a distant enemy in dark gray wool. The question, in any case, will answer itself, won't it? I mean, this is the sticking point. Either I can do it or I can't. If I can't, then all the preparation, all the planning, the files I've maintained, the expense I've put myself to when God knows I can't afford it, have been in vain, and I might as well throw it all away, run no more ads, do no more scheming, simply allow myself to fall back into the herd of steer mindlessly lurching toward the big dark barn where the mooing stops. This has to work. I have to get out of this morass, and soon, which means I'd better be capable of murder.
Donald Westlake, let me ask you to describe this character's plan for getting a good supervisory job back at a paper mill.
Well, it sort of grows gradually with him. He begins by realizing that every time he applies for a job, a lot of other people in the same, roughly in the same business apply for the same job. And he's sending out resumes, and they're sending out resumes, and one of them gets picked. And it begins with a kind of desperate curiosity. What are they saying? How are they presenting themselves that they get picked and I don't? And he figures out a way to attract resumes. He puts a fake ad in a journal of his area of expertise and gets the resumes just to see what they're like, and realizes that there is always going to be somebody out there a little better than him. And that leads him on to the next step of do I give in to despair or do I choose rage instead? And he says, well, I've got all these resumes, now what? And from there, it is somehow both a very large step and a very small step to say, let me pick out the guys who are better than me and get rid of them.
Kill them.
Kill them.
Now, I like that this is a crime novel, not from the point of view of a professional criminal. This is a murder novel from the point of view of a very middle-class, middle-management guy who's been downsized out of his job. He's always played it by the rules until this point, because now he feels incredibly cheated because the rules have been changed on him. And this isn't supposed to happen to the middle class.
Exactly. Yeah, the middle class is supposed to have given up all claim on the highs in return for not being subjected to any of the lows. And all of a sudden, that's not working.
You broke into writing by writing true confession stories, I think.
You know too much.
How did you get started with that?
Well, I came to New York. I wanted to write, and I was starting to write, and I came to New York and got a job with a literary agency, one of the ones where amateurs send in their short stories with money and the agent, or an ink-stained wretch working for the agent like me, tells that person, your story is no good, but send us another story with some more money because you sure have a lot of talent. And I worked for him, and he would get assignments from little publishers, paperbacks, book publishers, or magazine publishers, and you never knew what kind of a job offer would show up, you know, go write a story about this or that. And so when I first got there, his assistant, or another guy there, said, if that guy ever says to you, do you know anything about, say yes, whatever it is, and you'll get an assignment. So he said, do you know anything about confession stories? And I said, oddly enough, yes. A friend of mine and I did a content analysis on confession stories in college. And so I went on from there, and I pulled out that old content analysis and just did every recurring short story, and I loved them.
What were some of the things that you got from your own content analysis?
Probably the most popular one was the woman who goes to bed with her husband's boss in order to get him the raise and then discovers he would have gotten it anyway. That was big.
So did you write one of those?
Oh, sure. I think that's the first one I did.
First person, of course, because it's meant to be a
confession. Oh, those were all, yes. Somebody described the formula for those things as sin, suffer, repent.
No, was this a useful exercise for you as a writer?
Yeah, I think so, in a funny way. I mean, after a while, you know, it's like candy. Some of it is good and too much of it is bad. It was a learning experience in a couple of ways, in speaking in that female voice all the time, and in getting in and out of the story quick. You know, you've got 3,000 words to paint a life, really, with this serious or perhaps serial comic event in the middle of it, and then come out on the other side. So that was it was like good etudes, you know. It was good practice.
Donald Westlake recorded in 1997 after the publication of his novel The Axe. He died New Year's Eve at the age of 75.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Alyssa Block. Ask teenagers how they feel about high school, and you're likely to hear a variation on this theme.
High school was just boring.
And I was bored out of my mind.
Public school was really boring.
Those students found a way out of their boredom. They went straight to college without ever getting a high school diploma. NPR's Larry Abramson paid a visit to Bard College at Simon's Rock, where 15-year-olds can start work on a bachelor's degree.
The concept of Simon's Rock is simple. The last 2 years of high school are a waste of time, so go straight to college. Robin Kasky is only 18 years old, and she's about to get her associate's degree.
In high school, you're done
basically with your education junior year for the type of student I was, and then senior year is about writing your applications and sending them out during Christmas break and then waiting and crossing your fingers and hoping you'll get in.
Kasky is sitting in the student union, which looks out on this beautiful wooded campus in western Massachusetts. She is proof of the Simon's Rock concept. Kasky felt totally ready for college-level work when she arrived here after her sophomore year in high school. Like other kids here, Kasky says moving away from home that young was not a big deal, but one thing did surprise her.
I don't know, it was a bit of an adjustment coming freshman year and realizing that you're not the smartest kid in the room anymore. I was used to being the girl that dominated the conversation or got the top score on any test I was taking, and here that's just not the case, and I don't think that's the focus either.
The focus is on small classes and strong teaching.
Who else lets go the great wheel?
Gunnell
and Regan. Okay.
Before Hal Holliday arrives to teach, his students tell me he is awesome. For 90 minutes, he and 10 students discuss the play, seminar style, the way they would on any college campus.
They're horrible.
This is clearly college, not high school. No time is wasted on discipline, on announcements, or attendance. Simon's Rock Dean Sam Arumkorf says kids here are treated like adults, so that's how they act.
Taking our students absolutely seriously, intellectually. And we recognize that they're 15, 16, or 17, but we respect their opinions. We let them argue with us, overrule us. We want to know what they think.
Kids may be treated like adults academically, but when it comes to dorm life, they're treated more like teenagers, with closer supervision than at a typical college. But administrators say discipline is less of a problem when nearly everyone on campus wants to be here. That's the real force that holds things together. Oh, and there's no time to get into too much trouble.
So what are you doing on the weekends?
Homework.
A gaggle of girls is picking at the food from the school cafeteria. There's only one place to eat here. Leia Selitsky, 16, is eating lunch with her fur hat on. She says many of the social pressures of high school disappear at Simon's Rock.
In high school, everything is grades or everything is marijuana. And here, the kids who work really hard don't do it for grades. They do it because they love learning. The difference is huge.
Mindy Iser was an honor student in high school, but she says she was getting terrible grades. Then at Simon's Rock, she met her advisor, who is apparently some sort of superhero.
She is the smartest, most amazing woman, nicest, most... Oh, her brain is like this big. I feel like if I don't know something or if I didn't do the reading, I would be personally letting her down.
All these small classes and close relationships cost money. Tuition is $50,000 a year. 80% of kids get some sort of financial aid, but many students said they weren't sure their parents could afford to keep them here. Now, this place is not for everyone. That goes for teachers, too. They are intimately responsible for a small group of students. For Guidon Eschel, who came from the University of Chicago to teach environmental science, the difference was day and night.
Well, at Chicago, I mean, they can tell you whatever they want, but really, teaching is totally irrelevant. I mean, nobody spends any innovative effort to teach. Here, it's very different.
Different and a little lonely. Guidon Eschel says at Chicago he could find bright people in his field around every corner.
There isn't anybody in my field here. I'm totally alone.
Simon's Rock sees itself as a unique outpost, a quirky survivor from the 60s reform efforts that gave birth to this school. In recent years, the school has helped to foster dozens of early college programs around the country. Simon's Rock teaches seminars on early college pedagogy. But the school remains an odd duck, an enduring experiment that's tough to replicate. Larry Abramson, NPR News.
The nation's third largest employer is losing money. If you want to help, write a letter. Tamara Keith reports on the plight of the U.S. Postal Service.
Thousands of identical envelopes fly through a barcode sorting machine at a Washington, D.C. postal facility. It's mostly ads and solicitations, asking for charitable donations or offering new credit cards. And it's mail like this that told the U.S. Postal Service that the economy was in trouble way back in December of 2007.
We noticed a big drop-off in our mail volume beginning, and then it accelerated throughout the year.
Stephen Carney is Senior Vice President of Customer Relations for the Postal Service.
Our mail volume had its biggest decline since the Great Depression.
In the fiscal year that ended in September, mail carriers delivered 9.5 billion fewer letters and packages than the year before. Carney says the Postal Service made aggressive cuts and still lost $2.8 billion. Fiscal year 2009, which started October 1st, he says isn't looking any better.
We may have losses that are larger than the $2.8 billion we had last year. Revenue is not doing well so far in October and November.
Mail volume always suffers when the economy suffers, but this economic downturn is hitting the Postal Service particularly hard. That's because the slumping housing and financial sectors have typically been big users of direct mail marketing. In the third quarter, credit card offers were down 30% from the year before. That's according to data from the tracking firm Mintel Compermedia. Stephen Clifford is a company vice president.
Lenders and credit card issuers need to be more selective about who they're mailing offers to, so that's down.
Plus, he says direct mail marketing isn't cheap.
You send less mail, you spend less money.
And it's not just corporations. Postal Service officials say people sent fewer holiday cards and packages last year. More people are paying their bills online. There's even a do not mail movement urging people to protect the environment by skipping catalogs and paper statements. Dan Blair, chairman of the Postal Regulatory Commission, says this recession is forcing the Postal Service to evolve.
The question remains is, will consumers come back to using the mail? And more importantly, will the banks, will the credit card companies, will the financial institutions continue to use the mail? Are they going to look to using the internet as a means of communicating with their customers?
And if they don't come back, Blair says the Postal Service and Congress may have to more seriously consider some cost-cutting ideas that have been out there for a while.
For instance, are they going to be able to continue six-day-a-week delivery? Are they going to be able to keep all those small post offices operating?
For now, Stephen Carney says the Postal Service is adjusting routes to reflect the reduced mail volume, offering early retirement to employees, and changing operations at sorting facilities from 24 hours a day to 18. There haven't been any layoffs, but through the trims, the Postal Service has cut the equivalent of more than 20,000 jobs.
A lot of people have predicted the demise of the Postal Service many times before, including after the invention of the telegraph, the telephone, and the fax machine. And we think when the economy recovers, demand for our shipping and mailing services will be renewed.
And when the economy does recover, Carney says the Postal Service should be among the first to know, since mail volume is what you might call a lesser-known leading economic indicator. For NPR News, I'm Tamara Keith.